The 2026 Kentucky General Assembly is underway. And as I record this, there are around 800 bills that have been introduced in the Kentucky House and Senate. Hi, I'm Richard Nelson, host of the Commonwealth Matters, and thank you for joining us. I realize with that first introductory sentence, I might have lost half of you because I'm talking about laws and state government. And please don't tune out just yet, because there are some important bills that our state legislature is considering, and I'm going to do my best to make this interesting. And I think you will find this an interesting episode of the Commonwealth Matters. So I'm gonna go over some of the high points out of these 800 bills. Again, some of these bills talk about like designating a certain day or a certain month of the year, you know, making Kentucky the official cheese, beer cheese. That was actually an issue a few years ago. I'm not going to talk about that kind of legislation, but I am going to talk about things that relate to education and education policy. I'll talk about the state budget. I'll talk about citizenship status and reining in our election process. Some of these are the high points that are being touched on and introduced this legislative session. I'm going to start out with education. That's always a top issue. You know that half of Kentucky's state budget is dedicated to K-12 education. Fun fact, Kentucky's annual budget is about $15.5 billion. That's billion with a B. Half of that, almost $8 billion, is dedicated to K-12 education. So it's an important topic, and I think you probably want to know where your money is being spent, and so do our legislators. So a high-profile issue we've actually talked about in a previous Commonwealth Matters, but one that is getting a lot of attention is DEI in K-12 education. Of course, DEI stands for diversity, equity, and inclusion. It's interesting, when I had sent out an email update about CPC working on this issue, I had a link to an interview I did with a state senator, Lindsay Titchener. Some of you may have seen that program. Some of the pushback I got from family who are not on the same political side as I am, and even acquaintances, it was interesting. One person said, look, DEI, who's against diversity and being equal and inclusion? We want to include people. And that was actually from I'll just leave it. I won't go into who said that. But they said, how could you be against something like this? And I explained that DEI policy, as good as it may sound on the outset, it actually is a divisive ideology. It judges people based on external characteristics, race, sex, skin color, national origin, and it is elevating that above merit, the idea of opportunity, the idea of equal treatment under the law. Anyways, I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on this because we dedicated an entire program to it earlier in the year, but that is Senate Bill 26. Lindsay Titchener is a sponsor, receiving a lot of attention. I do expect it to move forward in this legislative session. And the reason why is because most Kentuckians, let's say you get out of Louisville, maybe Lexington, most Kentuckians are very much opposed to special treatment or looking at external characteristics by which to judge people or to bring this into the classroom or when it comes to hiring decisions. They're for equal treatment under the law. So Senate Bill 26 is moving ahead. By the way, I did something. I'm going to confess. I did something that I told myself I didn't want to do, and that's to give bill numbers, because that's where we might feel lost, and you're probably going to forget about these. I do plan to post the numbers in notes that I have on this, probably posted on our social media pages for future reference, or you can contact CPC's office if you want to get a rundown of the bills that I'm covering here. School choice. All right. Last year, a federal law allowed tax write-offs for up to $1,700 per taxpayer who donates to a authorized SGO. A SGO is a scholarship granting organization, and they would give scholarships to families and children who cannot afford private school tuition. I think it's close to 20 states that have opted into this. Again, federal program. They welcome states to opt in and to become part of this tax write-off, tax participation. What am I trying to say? It's a scholarship program at the federal level, but states have to opt into it. Now, here in Kentucky, Governor Andy Beshear is opposed to this. So there is a move in the legislature to designate Kentucky's auditor of public accounts to take on the role as a state officer and to keep a list of registered scholarship granting organizations and then submit that list to the U.S. Secretary of the Treasury. And this bill is moving ahead. Our legislature is pro-school choice, and I do expect them to move ahead on this. Those tax write-offs, the $1,700 that taxpayers want to give to the SGOs, that is a true write-off. It's a off-the-top deduction, a small amount. It would give some families opportunities that they would not otherwise have without it. Stay tuned for that bill on school choice. One of the trends in our state legislature, as I've seen it, are a number of bills that would protect minors in Kentucky. I interviewed a state House member just the other day about a bill that would prohibit social media use for children under the age of 15. Unless you're over the age of 15, you couldn't get on Facebook or Instagram or TikTok unless they had parental permission to do so. The interesting thing about this bill, by the way, this is not a new effort. Many, many other states across the country have tackled this issue. Some states have enacted laws that would ban social media use for minors under the age of 16, but this legislation is being tied up in court. This approach in Kentucky would put the burden on social media app developers. Again, the TikTok, the Meta, the X, all of these other app developers, Apple, they would have to have some kind of age verification in place before minors, again, 15 and under, were to get on to social media. There's an exemption here, by the way. If parents wanted their 13 or 14-year-old to use social media, they could do that. But it would require the developers to do the age verification. You know that the United States is behind other nations when it comes to protecting youth from the negative effects of social media. Australia last year banned social media use for kids 16 and under. Great Britain just banned social media use for those 16 and under. And the trend is to protect kids from vulnerabilities. What are the vulnerabilities? Well, there are predators lurking online. You know, it used to be when I was younger, we were told not to talk to strangers. Don't ever get into a stranger's car. Don't ever take candy from a stranger. That's not where strangers and predators are lurking. They're lurking online on social media platforms, and it's important to protect our kids from that. Also, there are addictive behaviors that kids are developing. They're doom scrolling. They algorithms find the kids where they are, and they keep feeding them whatever it is they're tuned into. There's another aspect that Jonathan Haidt, a social researcher, made clear a couple years ago in his book, The Anxious Generation. Haidt noted for teenage girls, social media use is especially harmful. They compare themselves to other girls. They're often harassed or bullied from their peers at school. Bottom line here, friends, is that social media is not a friend to healthy child development. And this bill introduced in Kentucky State Legislature would address that. I think it's a fascinating bill. Good first step. This is something that CPC is strongly supporting. Another bill dealing with child protection deals with anti-grooming legislation. Last year, I got a call from a legislator who was concerned about a high-profile case in their part of the state where a public school official was charged with grooming of students. And this legislator asked me for help with research and language regarding a bill that would make grooming behavior a crime in the Commonwealth of Kentucky. And that bill has been proposed. It's keeping in line with what I said earlier. I'm not going to give out bill numbers. I don't want to get lost in the weeds, but you can find the more information on our social media pages in the future. But the bill does this, and it's a lengthy bill, well, several pages, but I want to give the definition of grooming behavior. Under this bill, Grooming behavior means a course of conduct directed at a minor that is intended to establish an emotional connection with a minor through manipulation, trust building, or influence to A, facilitate future acts of sexual conduct, or B, normalize or desensitize the minor to acts of sexual conduct. By the way, I should have probably given a warning before I talked about this. I just jumped right in. I've got my policy hat on, my wonkish policy hat, and I just jumped right in. You know, it's disturbing that I've got to talk about this, and I hope that you don't have kids around as you're watching this. But this is a reality. This is happening in Kentucky and across the nation, where you read of children who have been preyed upon from people in positions of authority. It's not just public school teachers or coaches, but it's across the spectrum where we're finding our young people preyed upon. Consider this number from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. They track online enticement and related categories that fall under the status of grooming behavior. From January to June of 2025, so just the first 6 months of 2025, their cyber tip line received over 500,000 online enticement reports. These are often parents or family members that discover that a minor has been solicited or enticed to engage in activity that is harmful to them. Now, they're not verified criminal cases, but these are reports. But that number alone, over 500,000 reports indicating grooming type behavior, predatory behavior directed towards minors, that should raise real concern with all of us. And that's what, in part, this bill in our Kentucky state legislature would address. Grooming behavior defines it. It imposes penalties for it. And it's setting a boundary that when I was a kid, again, I didn't have social media. I didn't have cell phones when I was growing up. There was no such thing as the internet when I was a minor. But this is the culture that we're in today. And the vulnerabilities to our young people are real. The internet is a dangerous place for our young people. And I applaud our state legislature for trying to create safeguards for minors in the Commonwealth of Kentucky.
There's a proverb that says, when a land transgresses, it has many rulers, but with a man of understanding and knowledge, its stability will long continue. The idea here is that when people live without regard to their neighbors and without moral boundaries, then you need more government to restrain people who've gone off the rails. So if people are going to flourish, God's truth must be embraced. After all, God tells us who we are, what's our purpose, and how to live in harmony with our fellow man. Christians should understand what God's Word says and how to think biblically about the issues so that they can engage well. To stay up to date with what's going on in Kentucky, subscribe to CPC's newsletter. Go to CommonwealthPolicyCenter.org to subscribe, and you can also find other resources there. Thank you, and may God bless you.
All right, moving on to another super hot topic. It deals with immigration in Kentucky and immigrants who are here, even naturalized citizens, people who've gotten here legally. There was a bill introduced early on that would ban all immigrants, including naturalized citizens. And of course, a naturalized citizen is somebody who was born outside the United States, but they went through the process to gain legal citizenship. These are legal citizens. Well, two of the bills would ban any citizen who holds dual citizenship, who's a naturalized citizen, would ban them from running for office or holding public office. So one of the bills sets rules for local offices like mayor and school board and city councils. And the other bill puts those requirements in place for state offices like governor and attorney general. I want to be careful with this. I know both of the sponsors very well. I consider them friends. I'm not going to name names or even name the bill number, but I do want to bring some things to our attention here. And I wish I would have loved to talk to them before they introduced these, because I'll just say it right now. I don't think these were very good bills. As much as I love my friends who are involved with this, I understand what's going on. And here's the motivation behind it. There have been those who have held public office, who are in public office right now, who are serving in Congress, who run down the country, who don't appreciate our country, and that behavior is offensive to many. And I would submit, as offended as I am by that, the people in that given their congressional district, they chose to elect them. And I think it's unfortunate that you'd have somebody who's in office that would demean our nation and some of our ideals. Now, that's, by the way, is a First Amendment principle. You've got freedom of speech. You can criticize the government. That's part of what freedom of speech protects. And even being harsh against our government. But here's the veto power over that. It's the voters. The voters can say, I don't want that person representing me. I don't like their attitude towards our country. And I'm just not going to reelect them. That's the response to those who are naturalized citizens and are holding office and don't appreciate this country. That's my position, and I do believe that. Now, if these bills were enacted, you know that some of our founding fathers would not be allowed to help form our government in 1787. That's when the U.S. Constitution came into being. Out of the 55 delegates to the Constitutional Convention, six of them were foreign-born. Mostly they came from Ireland, Scotland, England, and the Caribbean. And actually, Alexander Hamilton, he's the one who came from the Caribbean. He was of European descent. Alexander Hamilton was an instrumental founding father. He was one of the authors of the Federalist Papers. It was John Jay, James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, who wrote the Federalist Papers. And that was very influential, very important to win over public opinion to creating a federal government. Alexander Hamilton would not have been allowed to participate in the Constitutional Convention. How about John Witherspoon? Again, very prominent founding father. He was born in Europe. So was James Wilson and Robert Morris. James Wilson, by the way, was on the U.S. Supreme Court. Robert Morris, governor. They wouldn't be able to hold office under this bill. By the way, John Paul Jones, who is considered the father of the American Navy, he was born in Europe, but he came to this country for a better life, for more opportunities. And he actually put his life on the line to defend the colonies from Great Britain and their overreach. He literally put his life on the line as he was the admiral of our Navy during the Revolutionary period. All right, moving on to another bill related to this, at least in an adjacent corner, American law. This bill would prohibit any reliance on foreign law, particularly Sharia law, when it comes to contracts or adjudicative rulings. There is an exception there. If there's an internal religious matter that the church or mosque or what have you would settle with their own religious law, they could deal with it there. But it would prohibit our courts, state court, federal court, from relying on Sharia law or any foreign law from relying on outside law. So this is an issue that Texas passed a law some time ago. I believe that Florida has either passed or considered a similar law. And this is becoming an issue of concern where we have a state statute, we have our state constitution, then we have federal law as well in our federal constitution. And what's behind this is that if there's a legal case that comes before a local or a state judge, you've got to rely on Kentucky or on federal law to address that. Conscience protections. I had a chance to talk with a state senator recently about his bill to prohibit discrimination against healthcare professionals who decline to perform procedures that violate their conscience. It also would protect and grant healthcare professionals the right not to participate in services that violate their conscience, and it exempts these healthcare professionals from liability for exercising these rights. So what are we talking about here? Well, in an age of politicized medicine, there are some doctors and nurses and other healthcare professionals who might be coerced or forced to participate in, let's say, some kind of gender transition procedure. So think of a pharmacist. Let's say there's a pharmacist with a robust biblical worldview on the human body, and they believe that God defines male and female at conception, and that to radically alter the body, whether through hormone treatment or surgical procedures, let's say that that person says that that's morally wrong. I cannot participate in that. This bill would protect that healthcare professional. I'm thinking particularly of pharmacists. You have people in Kentucky, gender dysphoric people, who are being counseled and advised to embrace the opposite biological gender. And the pharmacist in particular could be asked, hey, can you fill this prescription for, let's say, a high level of estrogen for the male who wants to have an outward appearance of female? And that pharmacist, if this law was passed, could say, hey, I can't fill that prescription for you. Here's another example. A woman who is in the hospital setting, and somebody comes in to have an abortion, but she's pro-life. This nurse or assistant there has pro-life convictions. She should not be forced to participate in that abortion procedure. That's not a theoretical, by the way. This has happened in other states. There's a nurse in Illinois several years ago who was put in that very position. So this is where this bill comes from. The bill is called the Recruitment and Retention of Healthcare Professionals. It would protect their conscience rights, and it would also make it clear that, hey, in Kentucky, we respect you as an individual, we respect your religious freedom and your conscience rights, and that's not going to be a reason for them not to come to Kentucky or for them to leave their profession. And what I'm talking about is steamrolling over their religious convictions. All right. I'm going to close with the state budget. No, I've got something else here besides the budget. I'm going to get to something else before I hit the budget. There's a bill dealing with sports gambling in Kentucky. As many of you know, we've taken a really solid position against the expansion of gambling in Kentucky, very involved, trying to keep out sports gambling back in 3 years ago. There's a bill introduced that would amend our state statute to change the minimum age to gamble on sporting events from 18 to 21. We're seeing a lot of young males in particular developing addictions and compulsions, and they're being hurt by it. The male brain, by the way, does not fully form until the mid-20s. This bill would also prohibit sports wagering licensees to offer prop bets, proposition bets, which are highly addictive. And this is where a lot of bettors are losing a lot of money. So I'm excited to announce that that bill has been introduced, something that CPC is very much engaged with. And I'm optimistic that it has a chance of passing this session. All right, we're just about out of time. I'm going to close with the budget. And if you're still with me, thank you. I know that some of this might seem kind of boring and we're talking state legislation, yet it's important. We should know what our state government's doing. We should understand some of the important issues. I'm going to close with the state budget with just a couple words on it. Our state annual budget is $15.5 billion a year. So every 2 years, we're looking at about $31 billion. It's interesting. The introduction of the state budget this year has a lot of cuts in it. It's a bare bones budget, but the cuts were made in a way that forces individual state agencies to find ways to be more efficient with their dollars. If you manage your household budget, or let's say you have a company or a business, you've got to justify your spending. And if you're spending more than what you take in, you got to find an area to cut. And unfortunately, state government is not forced to do this like individual taxpayers and like business owners are forced to do. On top of this, state government continues to get more and more requests. I learned recently in a private meeting that the governor requested ABR's additional budget requests, $5 billion in this 2-year biennial budget, $5 billion he's requesting for various state agencies. Now, the governor has a number of different agencies that are under his purview, under the executive branch, all the way from education to our public safety, our jails and court system, environment, health, children and family, Department of Health and Family Services. So they have real budgets. There are real needs there, right? There are real legitimate functions of government that the government, that the governor is responsible to fund. But he asked for an additional $5 billion. Other requests coming in other areas were $10 billion. Now, just these two things, the other requests apart from the governor and then the governor's request, that's $15 billion over 2 years. Well, that's an entire state budget. And at some point, you got to say, no, we don't have the money. And on top of it, the strategy this session is to have state agencies justify their spending. I think it's a great approach. Those opposed to it are saying, hey, what about this is going to benefit the rich? It's hurting the poor. I don't think they've looked at the details. And I'm talking about the Kentucky Center for Economic Policy. They often criticize whenever there are cuts to government. But one of the things, and I want to close on this point, for those that would say that we should not cut spending and that government should get more and more, it fails to take into consideration that there are other entities and other avenues to help meet the needs of the people. You have philanthropic organizations, you have churches and religious organizations. And one of the most important things here that's missing from the debate, yes, resources are needed, but we need more than resources to meet the needs of people, whether it's the homeless or those who are hungry or the single mom that's trying to provide for her kids. You need people with a heart who are willing to care and to take their time and to provide. And by the way, there are a lot of ministries and a lot of good work happening across Kentucky that are meeting those needs. And they're not requesting a $10 billion additional monetary appropriation. So consider that part of the dynamic to a healthy and strong society. Yes, it takes resources, but it takes people with a heart. It takes ministries and it takes work that citizens in a community, they see a need and they're willing to roll up their sleeves and to meet the need. Now, that, I really didn't have enough time to unpack all that, but I wanted to leave you with that thought. All right, we are out of time. Thank you for staying with me on this edition of The Commonwealth Matters. God bless and enjoy the rest of your day.